Welcome to the Florida Roundup, the statewide edition hour. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa Ross is off this week. Thanks for listening. DeSantis is the Republican nominee for governor, but until this week, he had not given many specifics on his plans on a number of issues, including education. DeSantis says he wants to increase spending on students and teachers by directing 80% of state funds to the classroom. He wants a constitutional amendment for term limits on local school boards, and he wants to, quote, ensure that the Constitution is put back into the classroom, end quote. He also wants to look through textbooks for anti-Israel bias. Meantime, Democrat Andrew Gillum has been running on an education plan that includes paying teachers at least $50,000 a year, paid for by legalizing and taxing marijuana. He also wants to raise the state corporate tax rate and spend the money on schools. Both Gillum and DeSantis want to expand vocational training for Florida students. So education plans in the governor's race is where we begin this week here on the Florida Roundup. Which candidate has your vote? How would either plan to change Florida schools? Would it be an impact in your neighborhood school? Maybe you work for one, have a son, daughter, a niece, nephew, grandson, granddaughter. What do you want done in Florida public school classrooms? 305-995-1800 is our phone number across the Sunshine State. 305-995-1800. Jessica Bakeman covers education for WLRN here in Miami. Jeff Solacek is the Tampa Bay Times education reporter. He joins us via Skype. Jeff, describe Ron DeSantis' plan that we learned and was released this week to us.
Well, a lot of what DeSantis provides to us is what we have seen in the current legislative cycle. We see a lot of desire for him to expand voucher and choice programs, keep tuition as low as possible, simplify and optimize merit pay for teachers. He doesn't want to raise taxes in order to pay for certain things. He wants to find waste and abuse and fraud in other places and bring that money in, which brings us to that whole idea of the 80% in classrooms. He wants to spend it on the classrooms, but we don't know exactly what that means yet. He really hasn't defined what it means, and so we don't know how that will play out or if it's even possible. It's a play off of something from 2006 where they called it the 65% solution. Now we're looking at his 80% solution, and it is a big issue that we're still trying to find out more about.
Jessica, DeSantis's plan did not talk about raising additional funds per se for education, as opposed to kind of maybe arguably reallocating the funds that are already there. Is that fair to say?
Right. That certainly is something that we hear from Republicans every year in the legislature. There's always a lot of talk about administrative waste, bureaucracy, that we should be spending more money on students and on teachers. I mean, Republicans in charge have raised funding for public schools over the last several years, but it's usually a more modest increase than what Democrats are looking for, than what teachers' unions are looking for example. And we tend to also have an increase in the number of students each year who are enrolling in the system, so that means that any increase in funding doesn't go as far. But it is interesting to think about the fact that the highest costs for school districts are personnel.
Right.
So if you're saying 80% of the money should be going in the classroom, wouldn't that mean to the teacher? So in some ways, you can kind of see a similarity between DeSantis saying 80% of funding should go to the classroom and Gillum saying we should increase starting teacher salaries to $50,000 statewide, make that a mandate. But with DeSantis, what he's saying about teacher pay is that it should really be based more on performance. He's pushing merit pay, which is, again, something we've seen Republicans in the legislature focus on in recent years.
Jeff, let's talk a little bit about teacher pay and the DeSantis plan that we learned about this week. He talks about rewarding high-performing teachers, incentivizing top educators to help recruit new teachers, compared with Andrew Gillum, which ran in the primary on an education platform of starting teacher pay of $50,000. Is it a safe assumption to say, with DeSantis wanting to say 80% of education spend is in the classroom, that baked into that would be higher pay for teachers?
It's possible. He wants to move the money around, and classroom teachers is, as Jessica pointed out, a huge expense of in the classroom. We had one of our other reporters, Kirby Wilson, meet with DeSantis here in Tampa, and he did point out that he wanted to get more money for teachers. And so that is one of the areas that we would expect he would want to direct the money toward. We just don't know what exactly classroom expense means yet. Yeah. It could mean a lot of other things.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that here, this 80% spent in classrooms. There's a presumption that, I suppose, in Ron DeSantis touting that, that it's not 80% currently, and that 20% somehow is enough for administrative or central administration or even principal work or janitorial work. Where's that? Where could that line be, Jessica?
You know, I don't know exactly what the percentage is now. I would imagine that it varies greatly by school district and even by school. I want to say that I saw a quote from DeSantis where he's saying it's around 70% now. I think the question here really is that this is kind of a conservative talking point. More money for the classroom, which means implicitly less money toward administrative waste. And, you know, also in his plan, he said he wants a full audit of the Florida Department of Education, right? So that's something that on the federal level, you see a lot of Republicans talking about. We should abolish the U.S. Department of Education. So I think it's a similar idea that, you know, he's saying too much money is being spent in administration.
Jeff, what do you hear back from school administrators? Are some looking at, say, wow, we could get a raise of what we can spend on administrative duties up to 20% under the DeSantis plan if they're if they're spending less than that now?
No, because they know that there are other costs that are outside the classroom, whether it's utilities, maintenance, even this whole new issue with school security.
Right.
Hardening the front entrance of a school is not inside the classroom expenses. And so they know that right now they spend, if you look at their general budgets, probably around 3 or 4% on district level costs that are just like totally district level. Mm-hmm. And so they're not looking at this as a big raise thing. They're trying to figure out, like everybody else, what is the definition, because that's going to make the difference.
Yeah. 305-995-1800, talking about politics and education, the two gubernatorial candidates from the major parties talking about education this week. That's why we're doing it here on the Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts here? How much money is enough money for Florida public education? What would these plans do for per pupil spending? What are your experiences as a parent, as a teacher, as a grandparent, as a neighbor of a Florida public school? 305-995-1800. Talking with Jessica Bakeman, WLRN's education reporter here in South Florida. Jeff Solacek is the Tampa Bay Times education reporter. He's with us via Skype. Would this mean the DeSantis plan, 80% spent in classrooms, his goal here, would this mean, Jeff, more state-mandated, state-directed education spending?
I think by its very nature it would, because they're trying to tell you what classroom spending means. And so right now, if they change it, if they say nursing is not a classroom expense and they want you to stop spending money on nursing so you can pay for something else, that's what it would mean. And so I think, yeah, the state mandates would be coming down and the districts would have to follow that rule if it were ever implemented.
I would just say that whether we're talking about DeSantis' plan or we're talking about Andrew Gillum's plan of a mandatory $50,000 starting teacher salary, in either case, local school districts probably aren't so happy about it. You know, there's always that tension that exists between the state and local school boards. And of course, the state constitution says that school boards have the authority over their school districts. But any kind of mandate that comes down from the state makes it a lot harder for school districts to find any flexibility to do anything different or creative or innovative. And so I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot of that come this legislative session, regardless of who wins the race.
You know, it's a great point, Jessica, because arguably what you're hearing from both candidates is more state control of education policy. You're not hearing really from either candidate to say these are decisions, teacher pay and elsewhere, that rest with the locally elected school board officials.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the local question is really an important one in both cases, but just to dig into Andrew Gillum's claim a bit, you know, $50,000 is a lot different in some parts of the state than it is in others.
Hendry County versus Dade County versus Duval, Hillsborough, Pasco County, Jeff, where you're at, right? I mean, it's going to go in a lot of different directions.
And one of the things I've been talking with people about, sorry, Jeff, is how, you know, a $50,000 starting salary, which right now is more than the statewide average for all teachers, that obviously puts upward pressure on the rest of the salary schedule. And so that could be unaffordable for a lot of school districts, maybe all school districts, even if there was a $1 billion increase, because that's not just going to be a one-time expense. This is obviously salaries are an expense that continues to grow as time goes on.
Jeff, go ahead.
And that's, I was going to say that, and I'm going to spin off of that, because the school districts right now have been adopting their budgets right now, and so they're looking at what their tax rates are, all set by the legislature. They have no real control, and they still are talking about the required local effort, which neither candidate has talked about, but which is probably a very huge issue going into the next legislative session. If the legislature allows school districts to just leave their tax rates flat rather than lower them, there's millions of dollars out there that they could claim just by the rising property values, and they're looking for that. They want it.
Yeah, as long as the property values are rising, then that goes up with the flat millage. Go ahead, Jessica.
And I mean, what Jeff brings up obviously is something that becomes a fight annually with the legislature, even when you have Republicans controlling both houses and a Republican in the governor's mansion. And if we end up with a Governor Gillum and there's a Democrat in the governor's mansion, you know, obviously Gillum's team and his advocates are also pushing to try to see more Democratic seats in the state Senate, but very likely we'll still have a Republican-controlled legislature. And so the disagreement around spending education funding and how to spend it is going to be even that much harder to resolve. And we've seen in recent years, you know, a couple years ago, Governor Scott forced the legislature to go into a special session to raise public education funding. That was with all Republicans in charge.
305-995-1800, talking about the education plans as announced by the two major party political candidates for Florida governor. Ron DeSantis talking about it this week, along with his Democratic opponent, Andrew Gillum. 305-995-1800. We'll begin the phone calls in Crescent City with Robert on line one. Go ahead, Robert. Thanks for holding on. You're on the radio.
Yes, good afternoon. Nice to be talking with you. Well, I'm going to come from a little bit of a different perspective because I'm president of a small college, private college. I'm also on the board of directors of a nonprofit child care center, which is, you know, preschool and VPK. One of the things I like about DeSantis, and I had a chat with him for 10 minutes at an Ocala rally, is that he's very much the school choice. And, you know, without saying anything against the public schools, I mean, some of the kids that have issues like with bullying, I know they just announced the Hope Scholarship, that Governor Scott signed it, and now you can get a voucher for a child who meets the criteria of being bullied. You've got the McKay Scholarship, the Hope Scholarship. But other than that, it's hard for parents to go into private schools and to parochial schools. Betsy DeVos and President Trump have certainly been on this wagon. And DeSantis says that he's interested in helping to allow parents to, you know, get their children into private schools.
And how do you feel about that, Robert?
Well, I mean, from my point of view as a private school, I mean, there are some parochial schools in this area that do a very, very good job. And the kids are going there like, you know, parents are sending them there because it's, you know, just better morals and it's more structured.
Robert, you mentioned you're in a preschool environment. Is that what said?
I'm on the board of a
preschool. Yep. Okay, gotcha. Robert, appreciate it. School choice there in Crescent City. Appreciate that phone call. Jeff Solacek with the Tampa Bay Times. The DeSantis plan we saw did push to expand school choice programs, scholarships, without using the word vouchers.
Yes, they don't use the word vouchers too much now. They like tax credit scholarships, which is what they've been doing. It's a way to keep the money out of the hands of the legislature and the budget. It just is it goes around. But they do want to expand it. And on the other side, you have Gillum, who completely calls it the unaccountable for-profit industry. They want to end vouchers, end charter schools. And so they're very different on this very important topic that lots of people are very passionate about.
Does DeSantis talk about where the funding would come from for expanding these kinds of scholarships that would essentially move, you know, continue to move some students out of the traditional public school environment?
Well, he did want to raise the cap on the tax credit scholarships, which is currently closing in on $1 billion. Mm. He wants to allow for more tax credits to allow for the waiting list to go away.
And just a reminder for our listeners, because it's a little bit confusing, but the tax credit scholarship program is like, say you're a corporation and you owe $100,000 in taxes, you can say, okay, instead I'm going to donate $100,000 that will go towards scholarships. And so that's money that the state is forfeiting. And so you don't have to come up with that money necessarily, but you do have to figure out where you can lose that $100,000 elsewhere in the budget.
Gotcha. Armando on line 4 in Miami. Go ahead, Armando. You're on the radio.
Yes, sir. I want to propose that this problem can be solved if the public school system will be closed down and privatized, okay? Because the public school system is a failure. I remember when I was growing up in the 60s, the first thing they did was stop the Pledge of Allegiance and the moment of silence. And then they started putting stuff like evolution and stuff like that. And the public school system now is an atheist, communistic system.
So, Armando, let me just ask you a quick question here. The Republican candidate here for governor, in his education plan, does talk about requiring the Constitution. He talks about bringing back constitutional principles.
No, I don't like Republicans.
Okay.
I'm afraid that Republican is a very racist person.
Okay.
And, you know, Trump is a very bad person.
All right, well, we're talking about the gubernatorial candidates here. But, Armando, we hear you. Obviously, someone who is very much disenfranchised, shall we say, with the public school system.
Well, and just to give a little bit of context, Florida's public school system, although sometimes there is still this sort of lagging reputation, has actually improved tremendously over the last, like, 15 to 20 years. Now, along a variety of different indicators, is seen as one of the highest performing states in the country. And there are almost 3 million students in the public schools versus much, much smaller numbers of students in other schools. Mm-hmm. However, that's what a lot of the Republicans will say is, look at the progress that we've made over the past 15 to 20 years, in large part due to policies put in place by former Governor Jeb Bush and Republican legislators since.
Yep. And Jeff Solacek, they'll also point, though, that teacher pay has not been holding steady with many of those states that Florida is now competing with, at least students are competing with, in terms of some of those economic educational standards that Jessica talks about.
That's correct. In fact, they'll point to the numbers that the Republicans keep saying are the highest historic levels and say that if you actually accounted for inflation and cost of living, that we're not even close to where we would have been in 2007.
Less than a minute left here, but Jessica, so real quick on higher education, also included in here, DeSantis has talked about holding the line on tuition and student expenses, very similar to what the Scott administration has been doing.
Yeah, it seems like what he wants to see happen with higher education would be a continuation of the policies of the last several years, including performance funding in colleges and universities. And he points out on his page explaining his education priorities that, you know, we now have 5 of the top 100 public universities in the country, according to U.S. News and World Report.
Jessica Bakeman covering education in South Florida for WLRN, our member station in Miami. Jeff Solacek is the Tampa Bay Times education reporter joining us via Skype. Jeff and Jessica, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us here on the Florida Roundup. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa Ross is off today. Thanks again for listening to Public Radio in Florida. A lower proportion of Floridians are living in poverty today than compared to a decade ago. About 1 in 7 were in poverty in 2008. A decade later, that has dropped, according to estimates released this week by the U.S. Census Bureau. Now, the national poverty line for a family of 4, 2 kids, is just under $25,000 a year. Have your fortunes changed over the past decade? Maybe you moved to Florida after the Great Recession. What have you experienced in your paycheck since? You can join the conversation. Let us know your experiences. 305-995-1800. Are you voting your job or your paycheck this gubernatorial U.S. Senate election year? 305-995-1800. 1800. Florida's poverty rate is highest in rural Putnam County, just east of Gainesville. It's also higher than the state average in Miami and in Tallahassee. One of the places it's lowest, Sarasota County. Barbara Peter-Smith is the aging reporter for Sarasota Herald Tribune. She's with us from our sister station in Tampa, WUSF. Barbara, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Is Sarasota doing something better than most of the rest of the state when it comes to addressing poverty?
That's a really good question. And I know that from Putnam County, we look pretty darn rich. But and the reasons for it are obvious. We have these natural resources, these beaches. We have these cultural amenities that draw millionaires to come and live with us. And you know, when statistics are based on an average, yeah, we look great. But last year, I actually moved into a different neighborhood, a more diverse neighborhood, and there's nothing like direct experience to open your eyes. So I did.
Tell us about that experience, Barbara. Yeah, tell us about this. This. Tell us about the neighborhood you came from, the one you moved to.
Well, Sarasota County, like many, many Florida communities, is subdivided and gated. And if you don't really want to be around people who don't share your income level and your socioeconomic status, you don't have to see them. So just moving to a different kind of neighborhood can really make the statistics come alive.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So I got curious about this income inequality that was right in front of us and we weren't seeing it. And it really did open my eyes about the way we do the numbers and what and the stories that the numbers tell.
So, you know, there's often said adage that statistics are like bikinis. They show you only what you want to show. As you moved neighborhoods and looked kind of into the averages of income in Sarasota County, what'd you find?
One of the things I've found is that once you get enough to eat, and most people in America now do have enough to eat on a daily basis, once you get past that, what becomes most important to the human psyche is how well off you are compared to the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important. It's a wonderful thing to keep track of poverty. And one of the things I learned is that about 55 years ago, there was a woman named Molly Orshansky. And she worked for the Social Security Administration. And up to that time, nobody had ever in the U.S. had tried to define what it meant to be poor. So what she did was she looked at the fact that at the time, this was in 1963, households spent about a third of their income on food.
Mm-hmm.
So she took she said, if you take the cost of feeding a family and you multiply that by three, that's the poverty level. Little did she know that a year later, Lyndon Johnson would declare the war on poverty.
Yeah.
And so this little formula she came up with was enshrined.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I think when listeners say the poverty line is $25,000 a year for a family of four, it's important to point out, Barbara, right, that's a national number. That is not a Florida poverty line number. That is a national number that takes into account the cost of living in North Dakota, South Dakota, Maine, California, and Florida.
Yes, and it's not just geography, it's age.
Mm-hmm.
When you're young, what you need money for is so different,
yeah,
from what you need it for when you're old.
Yeah.
And not only that, the formula is wrong at this point. In the 60s, a third of our income was spent on food. Now it's about an eighth. So you would have to multiply that cost by eight times instead of three to come up with a real figure of what it's like to be poor.
We're talking about new figures out this week by the U.S. Census Bureau finding that the proportion of Floridians living at or below the poverty level in the Sunshine State is lower now than compared to a decade ago. National Poverty Line for a family of four nationwide, about $25,000 a year. Barbara Peter-Smith is with us, Sarasota Herald Tribune reporter on aging issues. She's with us from Tampa. 305-995-1800 is the phone number. Let me bring in our other guest. Patty Mazzei is the Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times with us here in studio in Miami. Matt Dixon is a senior reporter for Politico with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Matt, is the economy playing much of a role in the election cycle this fall?
Yeah, it absolutely has been, especially at the state level, because Governor Scott, Rick Scott, has been in office for 8 years now, and he's touted himself as the jobs governor and the governor who has really sort of lifted the economy. So he's using, in his campaign for U.S. Senate, is sort of using that message that I created jobs and helped save the economy. Meanwhile, Democrats have pointed to many rural areas, as was touched on earlier, that have sort of been left behind in that recovery, or in Governor Scott's mind, that recovery. There's less jobs in some rural swaths of the state. Income still remains very, very low. So there's sort of two very disparate pictures of what the economy looks like based on, sort of which political flag you fly.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely becoming a big part of the race in the 2018 midterms.
Patty, how are the parties kind of taking and selecting the economic data that they want, either for the governor's race, DeSantis and Gillum, or for the U.S. Senate race with Governor Scott and Bill Nelson?
Well, as I think Jessica and Jeff talked about a little bit earlier, the focus on education is sort of less reliant on economic data. But today we had jobs numbers come out, yeah, and the governor touted them in his, capacity as governor, but obviously it applies to the Senate race. But then you had Ron DeSantis sort of picking up the ball and being like, I'm going to continue the work that Rick Scott has been doing. And reporters on Fridays like this one get a series of email messages from the governor's office for every region of the state.
They do.
What the jobs numbers are.
Yeah, we'll lift the curtain a little bit on those emails, because what I always find interesting about those emails is that the reference line, right, the tag about what the email's about, talks about the region, but also talks about the year-to-year job differences, not the month-to-month. When you get the national numbers, it's always a month-to-month change. But here in Florida, that the governor's office releases, is a year-over-year difference in job gain. So it distorts the picture a little bit. And then it also refers back to December of 2010, which, of course, is the last month before Governor Scott became governor.
Our colleagues at the Tampa Bay Times published a story today about economic statistics, educational statistics, health statistics in Florida now compared to 20 years ago, which was the last time that Democrats held power in Tallahassee. So that's another interesting comparison, given that, like you said, you can sort of show statistics to show whatever you want depending on the comparison, or like Barbara was saying, like depending on how you multiply it, etc. And I would sort of commend listeners to look at those numbers too, just if you're curious, because it also includes the standing nationally. So perhaps incomes have gone up, but we're still ranked 10th or, on any given measure. And so it's just an interesting, I think it's important for people to sort of get a global picture of this. And then they will probably vote based on how they're feeling in their own personal pocketbook.
Yeah, global picture, absolutely. But it does get down to, Barbara, as you mentioned, kind of how am I doing compared to my neighbor, right?
Absolutely.
That was your experience in Sarasota.
Yes, that's the most telling thing. It's how we vote, and it's how we feel compassion for people or the opposite. It drives everything that we think about wealth and poverty. Just how am I doing today based on what I see around me?
And as you change neighborhoods in Sarasota, tell us what those experiences were like. What were those conversations even like, and how were they different from other places you had lived?
People are all the same. That's one thing. Neighbors talk about what neighbors talk about, but the lived experience is different, and the needs you see are different. And it's very easy to ignore these things because housing drives almost everything in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Where we choose to live and where we are able to afford to live dictates everything else we see, from school district to what our transportation needs are. And it's interesting, you mentioned Putnam County at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I would wager that most of the people who are employed in Putnam County are driving either to Jacksonville or Gainesville for their jobs. So that's a whole other burden that we don't think of these people as having. And we may go to a restaurant and have them bring us food, but we don't really know intimately how they live. So that's the numbers. The way I look at these poverty statistics is if you were a lifeguard and you had 100 people in the water, would you say, oh, it's great, only 14 of them are only 13 of them are drowning, as opposed to 14?
Yeah.
But these are people who are just really, really struggling to survive.
305-995-1800 is the phone number. Let's begin this portion of our conversation on the phones in Jacksonville with Rick. Go ahead, Rick. You're on the radio. Thanks for holding on.
Hi. I wanted to concur with the woman who was speaking before that the idea that $27,000, I think you gave as the figure, could support a family of three is just utterly ridiculous. The way the numbers and the counting and all this is measured keeps that figure artificially low. Here in Jacksonville, I do evaluations for the court, and so I gather a lot of data on people's personal circumstances, and I can tell you that below a kind of a table of normalcy, there's an awful lot of fragility. People living on the edge, living by means of borrowing, living by means of combining household proportions of the year. And this is something that I have not seen over the last 30 years, being more or less involved in social services for that long. I wanted also to say that the statistics are skewed by the number of people living on $747 worth of Social Security that are not counted as poor.
Mm-hmm.
The number of people living on disability payments of the same amount, not counted as poor.
Mm.
And you asked, would we be voting our pocketbook?
Yep.
I'm voting not only my pocketbook, but everyone's pocketbook by voting progressive. I support a $15 minimum wage.
So Rick, you'll be voting for Gillum, is that right?
I will.
And you also vote for Senator Nelson?
I will.
Okay.
I can conceive of a better candidate, but that's the best candidate in that race.
He's the one on the ballot, then, it sounds like, that's got your vote. Rick, I appreciate your thoughts there in Jacksonville.
Right.
Matt Dixon, Politico, what'd you hear there from Rick talking about not only voting his pocketbook, but for those others that he sees in his community?
Well, I think everyone would say they vote their pocketbook, but in a sort of through a political lens, pocketbook is a subjective term. There are progressives like the gentleman who just called in, who think, you know, $15 minimum wage and some of those progressive ideologies are the best way to go. And there are certainly going to be others on the other end of the political spectrum that say, yeah, I'm going to vote for the Republican candidate. I'm going to vote for Ron DeSantis, but I'm too also voting my pocketbook.
Mm-hmm, when, sure.
You know, lower taxes and the idea that, you know, keep more of your money as opposed to giving it to the government. So I think when you bring in the political reporters on the economic discussion, I think it's a subjective view of things where both sides are going to be able to make their case to voters to say your best economic interest, your pocketbook interest is with our candidate.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's up to voters. You know, some voters are going to be dyed in the wool and are going to, you know, aren't going to be swayed or aren't going to be moved. And there are others in the middle. And that's
sure.
who, you know, folks are speaking to right now.
Yeah. Patty, maybe politics first, economics second, maybe in the mind of some voters.
Well, I have to say it's been 10 years since the financial crisis, and the idea that would, you know, that's not the only issue that is being talked about in an election. It's sort of...
It's very low on the national Gallup polls
now. Well, it's been interesting
to
reflect on, you know, we all remember what that was like. And it seems like a long time ago, and also not at the same time, but like the... Just how different the political rhetoric is from it when it was in 2008, right? When we were talking about bailouts all the time and mortgages in Florida was ground zero. I don't know. I just think it's interesting to reflect now that, you know, it was this week, right? Or in the past couple weeks.
It was in the past week and a half, I think,
with
the Lehman Brothers collapse.
A lot of coverage about remembering what that was like.
That's right.
Yeah. It's stunning. I mean, and like Barbara said, it is... The numbers are good, right? I think today that we found out that Florida's unemployment rate is at 3.7%.
That's right.
But economic inequality has been rising over the past decade. So there was a recovery, but it was so uneven. And can you, if you know, could some political scientist trace the roots of Donald Trump and mm-hmm. sort of mm-hmm. and the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street and
That's
all
right.
tie it all together as the years go by. Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, Barbara, talk to us about that experience.
Yeah, that is a really interesting point. The recovery was so uneven. The figure I keep hearing is that the top 40% recovered beautifully from the Great Recession, and the bottom 60 hasn't. And the bottom 40% probably won't. And that, to me, that statistic, that 40-60 split, explains so much about what we saw in 2016.
Barbara, let me sneak in another call here before we have to go to break. And Stuart, David is on line six. Go ahead, David, your thoughts.
Yeah, I was looking at, she said something about what poverty rate was at $25,000. I think that's really low because I own some rental property. My rental property is between $1,200 and $1,600. They're regular two-bedroom, one-bath houses. And I see my tenants working for $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that eats up a substantial amount of your pay, not including a car insurance.
Yeah, if you're paying $1,200 a month in rent, that's $25,000 right there a year just to pay your rent, which is the poverty line nationwide.
Yeah, and I mean, I look on Zillow in the areas that I'm renting at, and my rents are cheap. They're saying it's $1,400 to $1,600 all day long.
Have you had to work with your tenants on that to make sure they get paid on time?
Well, sometimes it's not on time, but I work with them a lot, but at the same time, I want to raise my rent so that I can afford to continue to pay for school taxes and everything else. And you know, they're struggling to be able to pay that.
David, appreciate your thoughts and sharing those with us from Stuart. Thanks so much for calling the Florida Roundup. Barbara, last word to you here. Your experience in Sarasota, is that applicable, do you think, to the rest of the state?
Yes, it is, because inequality is everywhere. You can look at it as rural and urban. You can look at it as coastal and interior. But it is in every neighborhood.
Yeah.
And what the gentleman landlord was just saying about rentals, there is a really good measure. United Way Florida has come up with something called the Alice Index.
Yeah, and it's at... I think
it's really well done.
We're running we're running tight on time. $56,000 a year was that number for Sarasota County. Barbara, thanks for joining us here today. Barbara Peters-Smith,
so
Sarasota Herald Tribune reporter on aging. Folks, we're going to talk about race and racial controversies in the governor's. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Melissa Ross is off today. Thanks again for listening to Public Radio here in the Sunshine State. So another week, and the Republican running for governor in Florida has found himself facing another racial controversy. This week, Politico reported a Republican activist and donor to the Ron DeSantis campaign tweeted a racial slur of President Obama. The tweet is 2 weeks old. The author, Stephen Alembeck, admits to using it, but told Politico he's not a racist. DeSantis said he was not surprised by the tweet and describes it as a side controversy. DeSantis disavowed the tweet. It is just the latest, though, in what's been a string of racist and racially tinged comments around the candidate, ranging from his own, quote, monkey up comment on Fox News the day after the primary to his appearances at conferences organized by an activist who has said African-Americans owe their freedom to whites. So the governor's race and racial controversies here on the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. Patty Mazzei, the Miami bureau chief for the New York Times, covering politics statewide in Florida with us. Matt Dixon doing the same for Politico. Matt is with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Matt, what do you make of this latest racial incident?
It has been just another in what has been the dominating narrative of this race over the first few weeks, from sort of the very get-go after the primary with the Ron DeSantis' comments that you talked about, to stories about him attending conferences that have been tied to folks who have made unsavory and sort of racist comments to the tweet this week. It is really, really sort of taken over the early stages of the race. It is early, so, you know, who knows if this is, you know, things change very quickly. Next week, tomorrow could be something new. But for the time being, the politics of race has been a really kind of a defining factor for the governor's race of, you know, the third largest state in the country. So it really is sort of not just a political back and forth, but it's a pretty important dynamic in a pretty important race.
Yeah, incredibly volatile dynamic, certainly at this point. And Patty Mazzei, you were with Andrew Gillum, I think, earlier today. Is he engaging on any of these issues, this issue particularly?
I don't think he brings it up on his own. I think if he is asked, he engages in it. He was not asked this morning in Broward County about this at all. It was an event focused on gun policy, so it just, you know, didn't come up. Yesterday, there was an interview by the Miami CBS affiliate with DeSantis where they did touch on this. From the point of view that he was in a safe Republican district, a favorite of Fox News, and
Ron DeSantis, a congressman.
And speaking to these sort of conferences for years, unchallenged, you know, with no blowback. And now he suddenly finds himself in this swing state, high-profile race for governor where the political dynamics are very different. The national media spotlight is on him. And I think the host, Jim DeFede, was trying to get him to answer, like, maybe this is why this is happening, because you came from a universe where this was not a big deal and there was not a lot of scrutiny, and now you've moved here. And DeSantis really pushed back because he does not think those associations matter as much as, for example, the fact that Andrew Gillum was endorsed by Bernie Sanders, which DeSantis is using to label Gillum as a socialist to try to make some inroads in among, you know, Cubans and Hispanics in South Florida. So it was an interesting interview, I thought, because you know, to what extent are political associations fair game, and who gets to define that? And do people care about, you know, a candidate speaking at a conference with people who say very objectionable things?
Right.
Do they care more about somebody espousing policies that they don't like? And I don't really know what the answer is, because we thought in 2016 that associations mattered a lot, and then they didn't.
And then they didn't on a national scale. Matt, could they count? Do they count? I mean, what's your sense here? As you mentioned, early in the race still. I mean, early voting is still 5 weeks away, but it's only 5 weeks away.
Well, Democrats are again doubling down like they did in 2016, certainly thinking that they matter. Andrew Gillum, Patty's right, doesn't necessarily bring this up organically. He doesn't want to, you know, be talking about some of this stuff. There's this tendency of candidates to want to stay on their own message, the official campaign, where they're going to want to talk about what they want to do, and they sort of leave the dirty stuff to either the statewide party or outside groups. And those organizations have been branding, just like the Florida Democratic Party and a few others, have been using this and branding DeSantis as a racist, while Gillum, like most candidates, will try to stay on the clean path and not talk about this. So the idea of it being an issue in 2018 is already here. The idea of it mattering, you know, I don't know that we're going to know until Election Day. In 2016, it didn't seem to, but it's a new cycle.
New cycle, and as we saw in the Democratic primary, perhaps voters that weren't getting captured in the 2016 polls, and for that matter, voters, Patty, that weren't really getting captured in the primary Democratic polls leading up to primary day.
Yeah, actually, if I can make a plug for my employer, the New York Times has this live polling that we're experimenting with, where people can see, as the calls are being made, how the numbers change in the poll, what questions are being asked. And Florida is proving a difficult place to do that, because the swing district that has been polled so far, which is the southernmost district in the state, the 26th district held by Republican Carlos Curbelo, it's very diverse. Which means you need bilingual phone calls in English and in Spanish. And you have apparently a lot of people who don't want to pick up the phone. So you have to make, you know, tens of thousands of phone calls to try to reach just 500 voters.
Yeah.
And when you see it live, it really underlines why polling is difficult. Primary polling was especially difficult. It doesn't seem to have captured excitement that happened in 2016 as well. And we saw it with the Gillum campaign. General election polling tends to be a little bit better because you can better predict the electorate and there's fewer candidates and things like that. But I think we're still sort of in this place where no one has found the perfect mix of online phone polling to master really to the level that people would expect. And also journalists and humans are just not great at talking about probabilities.
No,
margins of error.
Yeah, no, we're not. Race and racial controversies in the governor's race this week again here on the Florida Roundup. 305-995-1800 in Lauderhill in South Florida. Joelle on line three. Go ahead, Joelle. You're on the radio.
Hi, my statement was just regarding, of course, the racial things that keep happening on the DeSantis camp. We've got about a month, you know, to go before this election happens, and his position keeps getting tainted by racial controversy. I mean, I can't imagine any person of color or any African American would want to vote for him. But if anyone was even thinking about it, it's alienating potential people he could have gotten, and it's just not focusing on the issue. If there's something that needs to be said, if it's stance on something and Gillum's stance, then we can talk about that. But this back and forth of, you know, all these racial epithets and all these little pokes, as I call them, at ethnic minorities and people of that sort, it's getting ridiculous.
Yeah, Joelle, let me ask you, it's interesting perspective. And as a voter, I mean, we certainly saw that from the Republican presidential candidate in 2016. I mean, when Donald Trump announced his candidacy, he talked about Mexicans as rapists and thieves. But in terms of the overall electorate, you know, clearly he is where he is today.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that message falls onto some ears, and some people find that to be something that they might agree with, which is unfortunate. But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't know what's going on in terms of the issues that are at stake, and they're really trying to make some kind of decision and figure who might be the best candidate to vote for. And when these things keep popping up, it's not relevant to the issues we need to be discussing. Like, we have
Joelle?
Political issues here.
No, I get it. I want to put that to Matt and to Patty here. You know, you hear from a voter there saying, you know, these racial controversies around the DeSantis campaign, frankly, are kind of, you know, are distracting from real issues.
Yeah, I think there are definitely a lot of people who would say that the race issue is certainly a real issue. But I understand your larger point about their policy positions on education, the economy, things like that. And the point is a totally valid one. Every time they try to get some momentum behind the message of the week, the state level infrastructure week, if you will, there's these reoccurring conferences that really sort of kneecap that message. So it's really sort of difficult to begin to create your campaign's narrative and create the way you want to speak and communicate to voters and get your message out when you are getting these questions time and time again. No one's gone on you know, television really in a general election way yet. So there are, you know, lots of times to get the message out. But thus far, this whole cloud has really hung over the DeSantis side and has hurt his ability to message without question.
Patty?
Well, I think that interview that I mentioned earlier here in Miami yesterday sort of showed a little of defensiveness, because it's got to be exasperating to just keep getting asked about this, but it's only because more
is coming
incidents
up.
Come out, right? More people to have associated with. And I'm wondering at what point either the state party, in this case the Republican Party, like Matt was indicating, or DeSantis himself turns to a different attack on Gillum, right? Because if he keeps having to defend himself and the socialism line, you know, doesn't go anywhere, or maybe not as far enough or whatever, what will the next sort of attack be? Maybe it could be, you know, this FBI investigation in Tallahassee. And at one point, do voters just want to hear directly from the candidates and find out who they are and the issues and sort of get rid of all that noise?
They will in the weeks ahead. Debates to come, and we'll certainly talk about them here on the Florida Roundup. Matt Dixon, senior reporter for Politico, along with us from our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU, and Patty Mazzei, the Miami Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Finally on the roundup this week, a new scandal brewing in the governor's race. How to pronounce the candidate's name. Is it a short E or long E in the last name of the Republican gubernatorial candidate? Well, his wife says,
everyone knows my husband Ron DeSantis is endorsed by President Trump.
Ron DeSantis. The big-voiced television announcer says,
Ron DeSantis.
Ron DeSantis. Even the President of the United States, with the candidate standing right next to him on stage, says,
Ron DeSantis.
Ron DeSantis. But the candidate himself?
I'm Ron DeSantis.
Ron DeSantis.
I'm Ron DeSantis.
Well, for voters, you don't have to pronounce a candidate's name correctly. You don't even have to spell it. You just have to find it on the ballot. That's our program for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Kevin Murchard and Bridget O'Brien are the producers. Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, also our technical director. We had engineering help today from Doug Peterson. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. For Melissa Ross, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.